From Sound Vision Productions and PRI, Public Radio International, I'm Dean Ulsher with The Really Big Questions. And today I'm asking, how does music get so deeply embedded into our lives?
There's an album kind of in my darkest hours and my happiest hours that's been with me. It's Fiona Apple's When the Pawn.
I was at Woodstock and Jimi Hendrix was playing as the sun rose, and it just like blew my mind.
I really enjoy music as a form of prayer.
When I was probably 5 or 6, it was Paul Simon, You Can Call Me Al, and my dad had me on the hardwood floor spinning me around. I'll always remember that.
I'll talk with the evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker about his famous line that music is not an evolutionary adaptation, but auditory cheesecake. Also, I'll visit with the legendary jazz guitarist Pat Martino, who lost his memory after neurosurgery and retaught himself how to play. Why does music move us? That's just one of the things we're asking today on The Really Big Questions. I'm Dean Ulsher, and you're listening to The Really Big Questions. Our question today is, why does music move us? By way of an answer, I'm going to share with you what I've been listening to lately. You could say I've been binge listening to gospel music. And so this was a great excuse to pay a visit to the United House of Prayer for All People in Harlem, to spend time with the McCulloch Sons of Thunder. They let me come by on an evening when they were rehearsing in a small meeting room. The ceiling was low, the lights were fluorescent, and none of that mattered. The moment they started playing, the room was filled with the electricity of their music and their movement. One player who had just come in from his job working for the city transportation system changed out of his uniform, and he was especially on fire, dancing ecstatically while the band played. The director of this band is Elder Edward Babb.
We have been organized 52 years ago. I was 17, going on 18 at the time. We're still there. I was sousaphone player. It's a ripe age of 84. Our bass drum beater wasn't here tonight, but he'll be 95 this year. And so our nucleus, 6 of us, is still there for 52 years. We play this music from our souls, sweating, tie is wet, shirt is wet, even my socks are wet. And so we give our body, our soul, and our spirit to render this music.
Spending time with the band while they played highlighted how music can transcend differences in life circumstances. As I spent more than an hour with them, I was listening to them practice, and the music moved me physically and emotionally, and I definitely experienced chills. Now, this is not a word that I use casually. It's a term used by neuroscience researchers, including one at Wesleyan University, whose name is Psyche Louie.
My last name is Chinese. The first name is Greek.
How do you define chills?
Well, chills is defined as goosebumps or goose flesh or skin orgasms. Those are all sort of terms that have been used to define chills. But in our experiments, it has to do with an intense aesthetic experience that people get when they're perceiving some art that's really subjectively kind of emotional and strongly emotional to them. So it's that strong emotional response that's so very tied to a physical response as well.
Psyche Louie does research into other areas of music psychology beyond chills.
Well, in general, I'm interested in music perception and cognition. So everything having to do with, you know, why some people can't sing to why some people have this exceptional ability. And that has led me down a path of looking at individual differences in music. And there's really not very many things about music that are more individually different than our personal preferences and tastes, right? So there are some people who will really honestly say that some pieces of music, like Justin Bieber, are just really, really, really moving to them. And then there will be some people who will say, you know, there's something about Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto that's really doing it for me, right? So there are these huge individual differences in musical preferences, and yet a lot of people will report that they do get these strong emotional responses to music. And then on the other hand, there are people who never seem to respond to music emotionally. And so there's this wide variety of individual differences. And so that's what really got us thinking about the brain differences that might exist between people who are strongly emotional about music and people who are not.
And what are you finding?
So right now, the most interesting findings have to do with brain structural differences between the people who are strongly emotional towards music, so our chill group, right, people who always report getting chills to music, and people who are on the opposite end of that spectrum, people who never report, who report never really getting chills towards aesthetic responses, specifically in music. And what we're seeing is that the brain connectivity, structural connectivity between auditory areas of the brain and areas of the brain that are involved in emotion and social processing are more strongly connected among the people who have chills.
I'm going to run a little experiment now about musical preferences and chills. I'm going to play something for you that creates chills in me. Let's see if it does so for both of us. This is Tuvan throat singing. The people of Tuva in central Russia are famous for being able to sing more than one pitch at a time. They know how to use their vocal cords to bring out the overtones. Psyche Louie is not the only researcher who is interested in how music puts us in a state of mind that's best described with hyper-colloquial terms. Peter Giannotta at the University of California, Davis, is interested in how we groove to music. Do you have a single sentence definition of groove?
It's the pleasurable urge to move that's elicited by music. But I believe similarly important part of the definition is this sense of unity that people feel with the music or people who they're engaged in the music with.
As I understand it, this is a word that has caused trouble for you. How come?
Well, it's not exactly a word that one wants to trot out there casually. It generally conjures up associations of bad hair and bad clothes from the 70s.
So, and by bad, you mean great.
Well, it's one of these terms, you know, I think whenever you take a term from folk culture and then try to establish that as a scientific concept that one can study rigorously, you know, it meets with some raised eyebrows.
I see. So you're trying to get credibility as a researcher, you're using the word groove, and people in academic circles raise their eyebrow. And so why didn't you come up with another word that sounds more scientific?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I think groove is only, you know, one word that one might use for trying to understand a phenomenon that's multifaceted and requires a fair amount of explanation. But part of it is it's important to connect with constructs that people out there in the world identify with. And so, you know, it's important then to use language or labels for things that, you know, more or less people know what you're talking about.
So flow is a word that I know. Is groove related to flow?
I think in many ways there's sort of one critical way in which they differ, but otherwise I think that many of the underlying mechanisms are the same.
And so what's the way that they're different?
Part of the operational definition of flow is that you're performing at the edge of your abilities. Mm-hmm. And everything works, you know, like everything clicks and you're able to perform well, but you are at the edge of your abilities. That may also be true of many experiences in which you feel like you're in the groove, but I think that groove can also be experienced when you aren't necessarily at the edge of your abilities.
This is a big part of the mystery. As I mentioned, the McCulloch Sons of Thunder make me move. They give me chills. And yes, that sense of unity was definitely there, even though I'm not a churchgoer. But remember the church's name. It's the United House of Prayer for All People. And while the music continued, we were as one. We've posted a video of our visit with the McCulloch Sons of Thunder on our website. It's trbq.org. Why do we move to music? What compels us to make music? I'll talk with the evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker about his famous remark that music doesn't help us survive, so therefore it's not an evolutionary adaptation. It is, as he put it, auditory cheesecake. That's coming up on The Really Big Questions from Sound Vision Productions and PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Dean Olscher, and you're listening to The Really Big Questions. My favorite part of going to symphony concerts is before the conductor comes out. The orchestra's on stage, warming up, everyone's doing their own thing, and it is a cacophony. A beautiful, random, never-to-be-repeated snowflake of a cacophony. So this is me warming up. I play the bass clarinet with the Brooklyn Wind Symphony. Many members are school band teachers. None of us get paid for this. This is our dress rehearsal for a big show, the culmination of a lot of hard work at the Midwest Band Clinic, which is held each year just before Christmas in Chicago. For people who spend their lives in this world, getting invited to come here is a fantastically huge deal. It's like the Cannes Film Festival of the concert band world. Yes, concert band, kind of music that most people leave behind when they graduate from middle school. Middle school. The absolute worst period of time in a person's life. Some inexplicable urge came over me as an adult to learn a new instrument and work hard enough to become a high-level amateur so that I could essentially regress to my tween years. It just didn't add up. So here I was, along with the 65 other members of the Brooklyn Wind Symphony. Everybody had shelled out money and made a tremendous sacrifice of their time to come here. And I have to confess that my first thought when I arrived in Chicago was, what am I doing here? This is not my world. But by the time we were done, we had been through a transformative experience. And as the last note was still ringing in the hall, I had to choke back tears. What drove us to this moment? I put this question to Robert Zatori, who is a researcher at McGill University, who studies the neuroscience of speech and music. I tried to explain to him how performing in this group of so many people is like being immersed in the ocean. It makes me feel like I'm losing myself in a positive way, you know, and just sort of like letting go of my ego. But I wonder if you can tell me scientifically what's going on.
Well, the idea of losing yourself is an interesting one that many people describe, sometimes just when they're listening, more often when they're playing. I don't think we have a real fix on that scientifically, but we do certainly know that music really engages many different systems of the brain, and one of them is the so-called reward circuit, or sometimes called the pleasure system. And that's one that's very likely to play a role in what you're experiencing.
Now, we hear about this all the time these days. Being in love, it's the same as being high on cocaine. Doing crossword puzzles is the same as being high on cocaine. Everything you do releases the same dopamine. So my question is, why is this important?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think it's easy to overstate the case. It was a surprise, but perhaps it is no longer, that this reward system is involved in so many different functions. So now, having identified that, we can start to ask a more subtle question, which is, why is it engaged and how is it engaged, and how is it engaged differently by different kinds of activities? And one thing that we've been observing is that in the case of music, what happens is it's not simply that the dopamine system is engaged. Yes, that is true, and we've demonstrated that experimentally. But more interesting is that when that system is in action, it is active in a very coordinated way with a whole set of other parts of the brain. In the case of music, in particular with the cortical areas of the brain that decode sound. So it's not just the reward system acting sort of by itself, but it's the way that the reward system is interacting with these more highly evolved parts of the cortex.
So as I understand it, you're sort of flipping the question on its head. It's not so much, why are all these things the same? You're saying, what are the differences among either being involved in music or being in love or doing crossword puzzles?
Right. So the reward system may be the final common pathway that eventually you get to that system. And that's why the experience is highly positive or can be leading to repeat behaviors. In other words, if you really like something, you're going to keep doing it such that you will get to that reward again. But what's really interesting, I think, about music and other perhaps types of what we might call aesthetic rewards is that the access to that reward system is dependent upon this cortical system. And the cortical system is extremely highly developed. It's evolutionarily more recent. And it's the place where all of your experiences are stored. So that means that to access that reward mechanism, you're going to filter whatever you're hearing through your particular set of experiences that you personally have lived. And so going back to your original question, that's probably why this particular style of music may be particularly meaningful for you, maybe not to other people who didn't have that experience earlier in life of having played in a band and all of the associations that come with it.
So let me make sure I understand. You're saying music engages both this primitive dopamine-releasing part of the brain and also a much more recent, more advanced, higher-level functioning. Is music special in that regard?
I wouldn't say that music is unique, because I strongly suspect that other types of art and aesthetics in general probably follow a similar course. Now, of course, it's visual art. It's not going to engage the auditory parts of the brain. It will engage, obviously, the visual parts of the brain. What is really interesting, something that we're really trying to study now more deeply, is the way in which the reward system, which is quite ancient and that, you know, we share with rodents and other creatures, how does that system interact with or partake of a much more complex cognitive system that is based on cortical representations? And how does that explain things like preference and how is it based on experience? How does culture change the way in which we respond to different kinds of stimuli?
Do you have answers to these questions?
No, to tell you the truth, this sort of hypothesis has only come up in the last 2 or 3 years, so it's really a very, very recent idea.
Which leads me to ask a couple of other really big questions. What drives humans to make music? Did music ever help us to survive as a species? The linguist and evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker earned a lot of notoriety when he offered a possible answer to that question in 1994. His take was that music is like a rich dessert, invented for pleasure and not survival. One of the most quoted lines from you is your remark about music not serving an evolutionary purpose and that it was auditory cheesecake. And that seemed to insult a lot of people, right?
Yeah, people think sentimentally about music. They don't think rigorously about it. And they want it not to be insulted or dissed. They want it to be elevated and esteemed. And so it seemed kind of disrespectful to music. I think there's nothing wrong with cheesecake. But, and I think there's nothing wrong with the idea that we listen to music because it gives us pleasure. But somehow this sticks in the craw of a lot of people who study music.
Why?
Because they want to valorize music. They want
Why does evolutionary purpose do that?
It doesn't. It shouldn't. Many things that are evolutionary adaptations are by no means desirable, like genocide, that quite easily see why this could serve an evolutionary purpose. And many things that are among the things we value most in life are clearly not evolutionary adaptations, like reading, which only developed quite recently in human history and certainly is not wired into our genome. So I think people think of evolutionary adaptations as what is closest to the human essence, what we're most proud of as a species. And that's just a mistake.
I think people are also maybe uncomfortable with the idea that music is not necessary, especially when it comes to funding in schools.
Yes, absolutely. Right? It bleeds into the issue of whether music is as important as reading and math, and therefore whether it should be included in school budgets, which has nothing to do with whether it's an evolutionary adaptation.
Right. Did you foresee the firestorm that you were going to ignite when you wrote that line?
No. This was a couple of pages in a 500-page book. And if anything, since there is such opposition to the idea that anything in the mind is a Darwinian adaptation, I thought saying that there are some things that are not Darwinian adaptations would go over well. People hate the idea that sexual jealousy or revenge or differences between men and women are evolutionary adaptations. The common cliche is that these are just so stories. They can't be proven. They're just parlor games, except when it comes to music. Everyone is a Darwinian, everyone's an adaptationist, everyone desperately wants music to be an adaptation, even though it's the part of our psychology for which the evidence for adaptation is weakest.
And there is no shortage of theories for why music might be an evolutionary adaptation.
Well, there's the Mick Jagger theory that music is a mating display.
Well, even Darwin himself thought this, right?
The problem is that that's a theory of Mick Jagger. That's not a theory of the vast majority of the rest of us who enjoy music in private, who aren't particularly sexy when we perform music. I mean, the typical use of music is not Mick Jagger. It's like a 50-year-old guy giving trombone lessons to 9-year-olds in his spare time. The problem with that theory is that most music is not done to attract mates. And the Mick Jagger phenomenon has nothing to do with music. It's just that anyone who is very good and flamboyant at doing something is going to be sexy, whether it's athletics or literary skill or wealth or power. Music is just one thing that when people do it well, they become more attractive.
But it's difficult, if not impossible, to know what music might have done for us in the distant past. And then there's the point that Robert Zatori raised earlier, that music releases dopamine and activates the brain's reward system.
I completely agree that the motivational system, driven by dopamine, might be what music is tapping that gives music such a pleasurable quality.
Now, often researchers will say then, if that dopamine system is being tapped, therefore that's evidence that a biological drive is at play, that there is an evolutionary purpose.
No, that's exactly backwards. You snort cocaine, you stick heroin into your veins, that engages the dopamine system, and that's precisely not an adaptation. It's a way of tapping into. Now, certainly the motivational system driven by dopamine is an adaptation. It makes us seek food and water and sex and partners and stimulation. Once we have that system, then there are back doors into it. There are ways of picking the locks and stimulating it by other means. And I suspect that's what music is doing.
It's a squatter.
Yeah, it's a hacker.
That makes me like it better.
Yeah, I don't know why it should be seen as so politically incorrect to say that music gives us pleasure, and that's the main thing that it does, as if that's something bad.
You can hear more of my interview with Steven Pinker on our podcast. Download it from our website, which is trbq.org. These prayer bells, recorded in India, remind me that giving us pleasure is not the only thing that music does for us. In fact, I'm not actually sure that pleasure is the main thing music does, or that we'll ever be able to actually answer the question of what music's main purpose is.
But this is a huge topic of debate.
Anirudh Patel is a specialist in music cognition at Tufts University.
I think what's happening now in the field of music and evolution is we're trying to get beyond these sort of armchair debates, which will probably never end, and get into testable hypotheses about things we can actually go out and measure either in humans or in other species. And that's kind of why, that was the motivation proposing this idea that there's some connection between vocal learning and the ability to synchronize to a beat, because it makes very clear and testable predictions.
One of Patel's hypotheses is that only animals that can mimic and improvise upon sound, vocal learners, can synchronize their movements to a beat, because only they have the necessary links between auditory and motor systems in the brain. So this is key to grooving and to figuring out where our musicality comes from. One of the ways Patel is investigating this question is by running an experiment with one of his students at Tufts. They put me through it, testing how well I can keep a steady beat under three different conditions, while listening to a rhythmic pattern, feeling that rhythmic pattern vibrate against my finger, and then watching the rhythmic pattern. The idea is to understand whether there's something special about how we process an auditory beat. If we synchronize better with sound rather than light or vibration, maybe that gives us a clue into why music has this special ability to move us. The computer started playing more complex rhythms that were meant to throw me off. I had little trouble keeping a steady pulse while I was hearing and feeling the complex rhythm. But when I had to keep tapping while watching the more complex rhythm, it became so much harder. Wow, that was freaky. What a different experience it is.
That's the point.
So what did you find out by having me do that?
What we are asking with this experiment is, can you feel a beat? We know we talk about feeling the beat in music, right? That's a common expression. But the beat is about time, ultimately. And time is not tied to any particular sensory modality. You can experience time through your hearing, through your sight, through your touch, and so forth. And yet when we, in our ordinary lives, we feel a beat in music through audition. And there's a long line of research showing that when people try to synchronize with rhythms, even as simple as a metronome, they're much better at synchronizing if it's an auditory than a visual rhythm. So right. You might have noticed that
Much harder,
especially when the rhythm is complex.
Yep.
But even when the rhythm is simple, like the metronome, if we actually measured your taps, we would show, if you're like most people, that when it was an auditory metronome, your taps were much more closely aligned to the metronome events than with the visual metronome, even though it's the same, exact same temporal pattern going into your brain, but coming through your eye rather than through your ear.
I have to say, feeling it was no problem. I could feel it and I could hear it, but
yes.
Not see it.
Well, this is exactly what we're studying now, because the earlier work showing the advantage of auditory over visual is well established. But what nobody has looked at yet is to see if when you feel a beat literally by having a buzzing on your skin, whether you can pull out a sense of a beat as strongly as you can through hearing. Maybe you can when it's a simple metronome, but what about when it's a more complex rhythm? And that's what we're studying in this particular study. And we're particularly intrigued by the idea that when rhythms get more complex, you may actually, quote unquote, feel the beat better if it's coming through your ears than if it's coming through your skin and you're actually literally feeling the rhythm.
So what's your hypothesis?
My hypothesis is that people will be better at tapping to the beat of complex auditory than to complex tactile rhythms.
And that's what's surprising. Since we say feeling the beat, that metaphor.
Yeah.
Would make you think otherwise.
Yeah, you'd think that if anything, we should be better at feeling a beat when it comes in through the tactile system than when it comes in through the auditory system.
This is one of the challenges of studying something as complex as why we're a musical species. You begin by just trying to understand the basics of how our brain processes music or even a rhythmic beat. Patel believes that this ability to make music is limited to humans. We say that whales and birds sing, but he stops short of calling that music. Why is it, from your point of view, that only humans make music?
For me, it's because I see music as a volitional aesthetic act, not as something we have to do to survive, reproduce, attract mates. This is my opinion. It's ultimately about art, about creating this other mental experience that is somehow apart from the day-to-day business of getting on. And in all these other animals that we know of, the sounds that they make are part of the day-to-day business of finding a mate or defending their territory.
Like Steven Pinker, Patel believes music is not an evolutionary adaptation. And then there are the unanswered mysteries that may always stay that way. Why, for example, does it sometimes seem as if instrumental music is talking to us? As Pinker points out, music has a structure that's a lot like the syntax of verbal language. But since the notes don't refer to anything beyond themselves, music has no semantic meaning.
We have the feeling that music communicates, even though it really doesn't. But you have that illusion that a piece is trying to say something and that it is conveying something, even if you don't quite know what it is. There are some musical theorists who have tried to pin down the emotional reaction that seems to be communicated by music. And it's certainly impossible to narrate an actual plot using melody alone, where a man falls in love with a woman, but she's involved with another man because the other man is better connected and comes from a more respectable family. And, you know, I can spin out using words all kinds of tales and stories. You just listen to a piece of music, and if you don't hear the lyrics, you'd have no way of guessing that.
So are you saying that in order to qualify as a thought process, it requires the semantic part of language?
I don't think I would insist on that, but usually we think of, when we use the word thought, we imagine that it's got some sort of content. I don't want to sort of split hairs over what thought is.
For me, it's not splitting hairs. When I listen to a Beethoven string quartet and it goes on for 45 minutes, I'm engaged with it as a thought process. Mm-hmm. I feel that even though I know not to think about words and specific imagery, he's making an argument that's devoid of any semantic meaning.
Yeah, there's certainly intense mental activity. That's why we enjoy music so much. But the interesting thing is that it's very hard to pin down what it is.
Psyche Louie calls this emotional communication. She says that's a reason why she thinks that music may serve an evolutionary purpose. Artists and writers are often the first to identify phenomena that only later will get pinned down by science. When it comes to music's ability to communicate emotions, I don't know of any better description than this one by James Agee in his book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. He instructs the reader to get a radio or a phonograph capable of the most extreme loudness possible. Then he says to listen to a performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony or Schubert's C Major Symphony. But since we're already grooving on this string quartet by Beethoven, we're going to stick with it. I think Agee would understand. He goes on to write, "But I don't mean to just sit down and listen. I mean this. Turn it on as loud as you can get it, then get down on the floor and jam your ear as close into the loudspeaker as you can get it and stay there. You won't hear it nicely. If it hurts you, be glad of it. As near as you will ever get, you are inside the music. Not only inside it, you are it. Your body is no longer your shape and substance. It is the shape and substance of the music." James Agee has his finger on something really important there, that idea of getting inside the music. It has everything to do with why I play with the Brooklyn Wind Symphony, because I love that feeling of being inside an ocean of sound. And it's why I did something a little bit audacious when I was at the United House of Prayer for All People in Harlem. The McCulloch Sons of Thunder were arranged in a circle, and I just jumped right into the middle of it to be inside the music. Let me share what it was like. What are the limits of science when it comes to understanding music and the mind? In a minute, I'll talk with the jazz guitarist Pat Martino, who had to relearn the guitar after life-saving brain surgery. That's when we come back with more of the Really Big Questions from Sound Vision Productions and PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Dean Olscher, and you're listening to The Really Big Questions. I decided to try to get some insight into music and the mind through a route other than brain science. I went to Philadelphia to spend some time with the jazz guitarist Pat Martino. The story that's often told about him goes like this. He was one of the top guitarists in jazz. He underwent neurosurgery. It saved his life, but wiped out his memory. And so then he retaught himself to play the guitar by listening to his old records. The story that Pat Martino tells about himself is very different.
First and foremost, for the sake of clarity, I have to significantly bring to your attention that I didn't relearn the instrument on the basis of its technical demands. If anything, I think the clearest definition of what actually took place was I finally learned to enjoy it as opposed to accomplishing my intentions regarding it as a challenge.
Are you saying you remembered how to play the guitar technically?
No, I don't think I remembered, but I did remember how to play with a moment, like a child plays with a moment. Prior to the guidance of an adult to try to guide their children towards a specific achievement that will set them up to take a place within our culture and our society, which is referred to as success. That took place at a very early age through mainly my dad, who wanted me to be a jazz guitarist. This was not my decision as a child. My decision as a child was to constantly play, no matter what the idiom may be. If it was baseball, I enjoyed that. It was my father who would say, "Come on in here and practice. You have a lesson coming up." I would have never done so had it been up to me. I would have continued to play with my friends, like all children enjoy so deeply. No matter what it would be, there was a playfulness in me as a child that truly enjoyed the creative process.
When you describe your childhood, I'm reminded of Mozart and his father's pressure that he put him under to produce money for the family.
Amadeus, yeah, of course. Of course. I think that's something that is part of heritage. In my case, the guitar was a mutual bondage.
It would not be an exaggeration to describe the medical treatment that Pat Martino underwent as terrible. He recalls electroshock therapy, locked psychiatric wards, and straitjackets. Martino describes it as a development.
The tumor had grown, I was told, to the size of a pear and had to be immediately removed. I was given 2 hours to live at that moment in California. I was living in Los Angeles. But terrible at this point, I can't say that honestly, because I'm thankful for everything that led to this culmination. It would be foolish for me to blame someone for something that was necessary to experience so that the next stage of it would take its place.
Martino says the period after his brain surgery was when he redefined his relationship with the guitar, which he had come to see as a utensil. It was something useful, like a fork, that helped him to approach music as something deeper than a vehicle to success.
I treasure the authenticity of commitment to the moment in playing music. Not to enter it if it's a necessity or a responsibility, but to enter it as an ecstasy. To be able to sit and hold my hand on the instrument's fingerboard and to place one finger on one of the frets, on one of the strings that covers that fret, and to feel the feeling of vibrato on that string and the pulsation of its presence. I can't describe to you how rewarding that feeling is.
He has memories of one particular period when he had a TV job in Philly at the same time as a nightly gig at Birdland in New York. And that period has become an emblem for him of music's power to heal.
At that time, I was doing the Mike Douglas show in Philadelphia, and 7 nights a week at Birdland with Lloyd Price, and I would have to take a bus to get to the show on time for a 10 o'clock clip. 5 days a week and 7 nights in New York, back and forth, back and forth. It was amazing, you know, just to be absorbed in the life form. It was almost like a motion picture. It was a different reality. So I think that had something to do with the conditions as well, the way it held me up in terms of fulfillment. I think that was one of the greatest medications there were at that time, during those years, the fulfillment of the creative act.
The way Pat Martino describes it, this is music as therapy. and that has everything to do with how I've come to understand my involvement in the Brooklyn Wind Symphony as self-administered music therapy. So here we were, getting ready for the big show. Still, there was something nagging at me. There was one piece on our program that I just didn't get, and it was commissioned for us. And it was composed by one of the biggest names in the symphonic band music world, David Maslanka. He wrote his Requiem for the Brooklyn Wind Symphony. Every time we rehearsed it, it felt like something was missing. You know, a traditional Roman Catholic Requiem Mass for the Dead is typically a big, important piece of music. But this small instrumental work that he wrote for us at first seemed just kind of flat. Like there was no there. By the time our concert was done, I realized the problem had not been with the composition itself. We just hadn't been finding what was important about it until the day that we performed it for the top wind band musicians in the world. We somehow reached into some deep well of authentic feeling that had been missing up until that point, and we nailed it. On that same day, I found out from Kelly Cuevas, a flutist in our group who's also a school music teacher, that our preparation of this piece coincided with something big going on in her own life.
My father had been diagnosed with brain cancer. So, you know, I was having to balance the personal issues and family issues of making sure I had enough quality time with my father with all of the intensity of the preparations that we were doing.
So you have this personal thing that you're facing, which is huge, truly a life and death situation with your father, at the very same moment that this group commissions a new piece of music to perform at this festival, and it's a requiem.
You know, when the piece was first introduced to us, it was shortly after my father had been diagnosed last year. And, you know, the piece was passed out, and I saw, oh, it's a requiem. Great. This is going to be difficult. So he passed in July 4th, and we continued our preparations with the piece for the Midwest Convention. And to be honest, every time we played the piece, it was difficult for me. Every time, because I knew as we got closer and closer to the performance, our performance of it grew in intensity and emotional depth, which made it more and more difficult for me every time we rehearsed or performed it.
I think you're being generous to us, because I have to say, from my experience, completely dispassionate about the piece, I really didn't get it at all. At first, I thought, what? This is it? This is what he produced for us? That when we played it, I was like, this is kind of nothing. Now, obviously, I changed my mind, because by the time we actually performed the piece, it was, I would say, a transcendent experience for everybody, not just you, who have a personal connection to it, and me, who had my own journey with this piece. But I think everybody seemed to think that something special happened.
I wonder why that was. I wonder what made the piece go from just the notes on the page to a transformative experience for the performers performing it. It's fairly obvious for me why it was that way, for me personally, but I wonder why that was for the ensemble.
So I feel almost as if you and I approached this whole thing from completely opposite perspectives. Like everything about it could not have been more different. And yet we, I think, maybe ended up in the same place. But I started thinking about how odd it is that we all come together and have this somewhat deep personal experience with people we don't know very well.
That is kind of odd when you think about it. But it's one of those things that anyone who's ever been in an ensemble and part of a group that created something that gave you at least one moment of that emotional, expressive cohesiveness. Only when you've experienced that can you understand it. It's one of the things that I wish I could package up and give to my students and say, look, stick with it, because this is what you're going to get to experience, and it's like nothing else.
Lifelong engagement with music. I think that's my experience here has made me want to require music in the schools for that reason. Not because it'll make you smarter, because listening to Mozart won't make you smarter. But it will make your life so much better.
Right. It's interesting you say that, because I've kind of had a shift in my teaching over the past year, where I'm just trying to shift more towards getting kids to connect with that emotional, expressive aspect of music, and less about push this button and play this note, and if you get it right, you get a 100, if you don't, you don't. To just trying to shift away from that towards just getting them to have an expressive emotional experience.
There is still so much to learn about why music moves us. I would love it if this question could be answered in my lifetime. But I have to say that just asking the question has been a worthwhile reminder that music helps to define who we are.
There's something about music that makes us human in the sense that every human culture has music. Every human culture makes music, and they not only make music, they celebrate making of music. And even from the first day of life, we know that the brain has all these knowledge of, for instance, beat and rhythm. And that really just develops very quickly over time. So I think there's very few other domains of human function that really tap into all those aspects of the brain.
I think music is a great example of a quintessentially human behavior because it's an invention that I believe transforms our life, our inner life. And so humans are a remarkable species in that the things that we invent transform our world. You look at everything from architecture to clothing to technology to filmmaking. We constantly invent things that change our world and our experience of the world, and I think music may have been the earliest example of that.
There is still so much to learn, not only from scientists, but also from the people we get to know through their music.
This music has icing on the cake that would actually heal you from all manner of disease. This music actually would uplift you because we play this music from our souls.
The Really Big Questions is produced by Flora Lichtman and me, Dean Olscher, with production assistance from Emily Havoc. Our editor is Michelle Nyhaus. Our recording engineer is Scott Lehrer. Technical director and mix engineer is Robin Wise. Digital producer is Chris Julin. Mary Beth Kirchner is the managing producer, and the executive producer is Barry Scott. And special thanks to our advisor, John Everson. Requiem was written by David Maslanka and published by Maslanka Press, thanks to Mark Custom Recordings. Additional music by composer and trombonist James Hall. Beethoven's Opus 135 was performed by the Borromeo String Quartet at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. The Tuvensingers' Hun Hurtu and Bruce Miller's field recording of Indian Prayer Bells are at the Free Music Archive. Visit us on Facebook to ask your really big question and check out our podcast. You can get it on iTunes or on our website, which is trbq.org. And we're also on Twitter at trbqs. The Really Big Questions is produced by SoundVision Productions in association with the Exploratorium and Public Radio International with funds from the National Science Foundation. I'm Dean Olscher. So long for now.
Thank you. PRI. Public Radio International.